You are currently on hold for Judge John Roberts' confirmation briefing conference call. We are currently awaiting additional participants. We'd like to thank you for your patience and ask that you please continue to hold.
So we are standing by. This is Indie Bay Radio. Indie Bay in San Francisco is part of the Indie Media News Service. And here in San Francisco, we have two different versions of Indie Media. One, San Francisco Indie Media, handles pretty much San Francisco-related issues, and Indie Bay handles Bay Area, to some degrees, Northern California issues. We are standing by to help record the upcoming press conference regarding the Judge Roberts nomination. Judge Roberts, of course, is the figure who has been nominated by Bush to cover for Sandra Day O'Connor. And, of course, many people are rather disturbed that the first woman on the Supreme Court has now been replaced by another white male. And that would be the least of the problems of this nominee. Of course, another aspect of Judge Roberts is that he apparently is active in what's called the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society, of course, is a strange neocon organization that's been active in past years, probably for almost 20 years, working to stack the deck of the judiciary, and they don't limit themselves to federal seats, although this would be a real nice plum. The Federalist Society has been looking at all sorts of municipal, state, local, and federal seats for a good long time, stacking the deck for their corporate well-being, let's say. So we are interested in whether or not there's going to be any kind of opposition. One of the first chinks in the armor of Judge Roberts was when he was asked about his relationship to the Federalist Society, and he claimed that he had no contacts with them and no real membership role. I believe his comment was that he can't remember having any kind of dues relationship to them. And so someone dug up the roll books for the Federalist Society. I believe it was for 1998 and 99, and it was discovered that he's on their leadership committee, their steering committee. And so that's great news as far as I'm concerned. Not only is he afraid to admit his position within the Federalist Society, but it creates the opportunity to declare that he's an outright liar. So this press conference coming up, apparently the booked participants, Hillary Shelton, is the director of the NAACP, part of the Washington Bureau. Jim Ward will be the another participant. He's the president of ADA Watch, National Coalition for Disability Rights. And then Judy Applebaum is the vice president and legal director of the National Women's Law Center. And
briefing conference call. We are still awaiting additional participants. We'd like to thank you for your patience and ask that you please continue to hold.
And so as you hear, we're still on hold with the press conference about to begin momentarily. The press release, just to read it, these coalition leaders will raise in-depth questions and concerns about how a Roberts confirmation to the Supreme Court could affect civil rights and disability rights, including laws guarding against civil rights violations, protecting disability rights, protecting women's rights, including Title IX of affirmative action, gender discrimination, work and family rights, and reproductive rights. And if you'd like more information specifically on this press conference, you can go to their website, independentcourt.org. And just for curiosity's sake, I'll click on that link, and sure enough, we've got a website that comes up pretty quick. By the way, the three people that are listed are pretty much just leaning on civil rights issues, but John Roberts is pretty much a corporate state type. Can look at his desires essentially to give any number of additional rights to corporations and take them away from humans. So as you may know, Ralph Nader, of course, has been talking about the corporate personhood problem, that for many years corporations had been granted essentially a status of equality to humans, and that as that goes, the corporations have been able to, if you know about the the structure of a corporation, it's designed in such a way that a corporation does not take responsibility under normal company status. If you're looking for a business license in a county or a state, you will take responsibility, liability, if there are hazardous waste spills or injuries on the job. But a corporation is structured in such a way that the costs are dispersed. So the shareholders are not personally liable for damages and injuries in and around their properties. So corporations were founded under this principle many many hundreds of years ago, and in fact the original 13 colonies were 13 corporations, and so it's always been a matter of colonization. When you have corporations, you have colonies, and so the corporate backers of Bush and Roberts are certainly to be looked at askance. Let's see. So we see here that as part of his civil rights record, Roberts has opposed efforts to make the Voting Rights Act more effective. He has also argued that Roe v. Wade should be overruled. He's now, I believe he's claimed that overruled statement was one in which he was working for his client, which was, in this case, the U.S. government under Ronald Reagan. But that's a pretty dubious argument, because the Constitution says that you have equal justice under the law, and the idea that Roe v. Wade should be overruled is denying equal justice under the law. He's also written about a so-called right, quote, so-called right to privacy, unquote, and, quote, so-called fundamental rights, unquote. These are also rather cheesy. Right to privacy is something that is pretty easily looked at as in common law from long before the American Revolution. And so-called fundamental rights, I believe that would be the Fourth Amendment, in which many more rights are not enumerated. And the idea that the Declaration of Independence gives us life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness are not written into the Constitution is as if a bait and switch, that we in America can have a Declaration of Independence that we learn to memorize in high school, but then we discover later in our lives that none of it counts because it's not written into the Constitution as well. Sounds like they're just coming up.
Thank you for standing by, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Judge John Roberts Confirmation Briefing Conference Call. This conference is being recorded. And now at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Phil Sparks for opening remarks and introductions. Mr. Sparks, please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and thanks all to the press, especially some of you all that dialed in at the top of the hour, and we waited for a moment in order to get all reporters accommodated on the lines. want to welcome you to today's audio news conference to talk about the legal and judicial record of Supreme Court nominee Roberts from the disability, women's rights, and civil rights points of view. We'll have three brief opening statements, and then we'll go right to your questions and answers. Joining us today are three people that represent those various communities: Jim Ward, W-A-R-D, president of ADA Watch / the National Coalition for Disability Rights; Judy Applebaum, A-P-P-E-L-B-A-U-M, she's vice president and legal director of the National Women's Law Center; and Hillary Shelton, S-H-E-L-T-O-N. Hillary is the director of the NAACP Washington Bureau. We'll begin with comments from Jim Ward. Jim?
Thank you, Phil, and good afternoon to all of you. ADA Watch and the National Coalition for Disability Rights is indeed opposed to the nomination of Judge John Roberts to a lifetime seat on the court. At a time when our nation could have greatly benefited from the selection of a mainstream consensus nominee, people with disabilities, indeed all Americans, should be saddened and disturbed by President Bush's choice of Judge John Roberts to fill Sandra Day O'Connor's seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. While Justice O'Connor did not take the side of people with disabilities in all cases, she was a swing vote on important 5-4 rulings involving the Americans with Disabilities Act, including historic cases such as Olmstead versus LC and Tennessee versus Lane. With the selection of John Roberts, President Bush is making good on his stated intention to fill a court vacancy with a nominee in the mold of Scalia or Thomas, justices who have consistently ruled against people with disabilities in these and other landmark cases. ADA Watch applauds Senator Leahy's determination to obtain the release of withheld documents that will shed light on Roberts' record. Each day, as new documents are uncovered, we get a clearer picture of Roberts' views, many of which lay outside of the mainstream. For example, Reagan administration documents demonstrate Roberts' role in attempting to undermine the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. And today, the Washington Post reported on documents that indicate that Roberts uncritically passed along, quote, demands that the administration repeal a requirement of government contractors to hire the handicapped, end quote. We also applaud Senator Sepp Specter's letter of August 23rd to Mr. Roberts, seeking his opinions on judicial activism demonstrated by the Rehnquist Court, especially in regard to the narrowing of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the failure to respect the intent of Congress in crafting this historic and bipartisan law. Mr. Roberts does, in fact, have a very different view of judicial activism. In Board of Education versus Rowley, an 8-year-old student who was deaf sought to have a sign language interpreter provided to assist her in school. The trial court ruled that federal law required the state to provide an interpreter for her. The appeals court affirmed. Roberts, while at the Justice Department, wrote a memo to the Attorney General criticizing these decisions. He stated that the lower courts, in an exercise of, quote, judicial activism, used vague statutory language to overrule the board and substitute their own judgment. So what Roberts and others calls vague, Congress in passing the ADA, of course, called expansive rights. Mr. Roberts' views reveal that he will not only continue this trend of right-wing judicial activism, but would further it, risking our remaining protections spared only by Justice O'Connor's siding with the majority in cases that preserved our rights. Our concerns are illustrated by Mr. Roberts' 2000 television interview in which he declared that the Rehnquist Court was, quote, not conservative enough. And Roberts, of course, later convinced the Rehnquist Court to eliminate ADA protections for millions of Americans with disabilities, especially those with epilepsy, diabetes, mental illness, and work-related injuries. And that was in the Toyota versus Williams case. Indeed, Judge Roberts has a long history of advocating for the weakening of legal protections for children and adults with disabilities under the ADA, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the Child Welfare Act, and education law, as well as the very legal underpinnings of such laws included in Congress's commerce power. So we share Senator Specter's concerns that in the Rehnquist Court, we are witnessing judicial activism to roll back federal protections, including the ADA, with the use of, quote, manufactured rationales used by the Supreme Court to exercise the role of a super legislature and make public policy decisions, which is the core congressional role under the Constitution, end quote. That's from Specter's letter. Based on this record, we are concerned that the ADA, a bipartisan law that seldom attracts public attention similar to the hot-button issues often debated in the context of Supreme Court confirmation hearings, will be further weakened should Judge John Roberts be confirmed. So we call on the Senate Judiciary Committee to allow testimony from the representatives of the disability community and to fully examine Judge Roberts' records and views in regards to the Americans with Disabilities Act and disability rights protections generally. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim Ward. And Jim, why don't you, in case reporters want to talk to you sidebar afterwards, why don't you give both your telephone number and if you've got a URL where you've got some of that fairly complicated information, why don't you pass that along too?
Certainly. My number is 202-415-4753. And you can find us on the web at adawatch.org. And I also recommend posted document called John Roberts' Problematic Record on Disability Rights, and that's posted on bazelon.org, B-A-Z-E-L-O-N.org.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Judy Applebaum. Judy, as we said, is the Vice President and Legal Director of the National Women's Law Center. Judy?
Thank you, Phil. Yes, and the National Women's Law Center is an organization that has been working to advance and protect women's legal rights for over 30 years. So we've been engaged for the past several weeks in a comprehensive review of the publicly available documents reflecting John Roberts' record, with, of course, a focus on legal issues of particular importance to women. We're finding that his record raises very serious concerns for us in a number of areas, but I'll focus this afternoon on his civil rights record in two particular areas, the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, as it applies to sex discrimination, and Title IX. Very briefly. First, on equal protection. It has been settled by Supreme Court precedents since the 1970s that under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, a law or government policy that discriminates on the basis of sex is subject to what's called heightened scrutiny, which means that it will be struck down unless the government can supply an exceedingly persuasive justification for it. That's the court's language. This principle is no small matter. It's critical to ensuring that laws and policies based on outmoded stereotypes and generalizations about the roles of women and men in society won't be sustained. But John Roberts, in memos he wrote in the Reagan administration, repeatedly objected to and ignored this legal standard. In fact, based in part on his objection to heightened scrutiny for sex discrimination, he even opposed Justice Department intervention in a sex discrimination case that others in that administration, and ultimately the court, found compelling. Even William Bradford Reynolds wanted to intervene. He was a DOJ official who was later rejected by the Republican-controlled Senate Judiciary Committee for confirmation to a higher office in the department, in part because of his narrow approach to civil rights enforcement. But unlike William Bradford Reynolds, John Roberts wanted the department to stay out of this sex discrimination case. Fortunately, he was overruled, the department did intervene, and the plaintiffs won. On Title IX, that, of course, is the federal law that prohibits sex discrimination by educational institutions receiving federal financial assistance. And I want to emphasize that it's a law that's parallel to other important anti-discrimination laws that prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, disability, and age by institutions receiving federal funds. So harmful interpretations of Title IX also affect and apply to those other laws and those other forms of discrimination. John Roberts, through his career, repeatedly urged narrow and damaging interpretations of Title IX. For example, early in the Reagan administration, he argued that student aid, federal student loans and grants, didn't trigger Title IX coverage at all. Then he argued that when Title IX does apply, it covers only the specific program getting the federal funds, not the institution as a whole. This meant, it's important to underline it, this meant no coverage of intercollegiate athletics, which had that prevailed over time would have, I think, changed a great deal in our country. And it also produced absurd results like one university that was being investigated for an episode of sexual harassment by the Department of Education, and the department had to end the investigation because the building that the harassment took place in did not receive federal aid for its construction or renovation. If the activity had taken place in another building on campus where there was federal support, the law would have applied. So Roberts was arguing for a narrow construction of Title IX there. Then, later, as Deputy Solicitor General in the first Bush administration, he argued that no victim of intentional sex discrimination could recover damages when a violation was shown under Title IX. This was in a sexual harassment case involving a high school girl whose teacher had sexually abused her repeatedly and over a period of time. There, the Supreme Court emphatically and unanimously disagreed with the U.S. government's argument presented in a brief co-authored by John Roberts. Finally, in private practice, he represented the NCAA and argued that Title IX doesn't cover the NCAA based on its receipt of dues from schools that are covered. And there the Supreme Court agreed, but Roberts made a broader argument that Title IX shouldn't be covered, that the NCAA couldn't be covered for any reason, for example, its control over intercollegiate athletics. So there's a pattern there, and these aspects of his record are very troubling to us. And I should say there are other issues, too, for example, his record on employment discrimination, affirmative action, and, of course, the right to privacy. So we're especially concerned because he's been named to the O'Connor seat, and Justice O'Connor wrote opinions and cast the decisive vote in a number of key cases that strengthened women's rights in all of these areas. So I will end this brief opening by saying that on the equal protection and Title IX issues that I've touched upon, we have a piece that you can find on our website. It's called Judge John Roberts' Record on Protection from Sex Discrimination under Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause, and that is on our website at www.nwlc.org, and a number of other good materials are there as well. And you could also check out our blog, which is www.nominationwatch.org, where there's a lot of information about various aspects of the Roberts record. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. And why don't you give everybody your phone number in case people want to talk to you sidebar?
Sure. 202-588-5180.
Fine. Our final speaker is Hillary Shelton of the NAACP's Washington Bureau. Hillary.
Thank you very much. Throughout his career, Judge Roberts has advocated for dismantling of many of the gains we have made in civil rights over the last 40 years, including equal opportunity programs like affirmative action, voting rights, employment protection, and public school desegregation. He has articulated extremist views and supported an agenda outside the scope of established civil rights laws as well as mainstream judicial thought. During his years with the Reagan administration, he continued to argue in support of misguided and harmful positions, often placing himself to the political right of staunchly conservative Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights William Bradford Reynolds, Assistant Attorney General Ted Olson, Solicitor General Rex Lee, and even one-time Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork on issues of stripping the Supreme Court of authority in addressing a class of cases which include busing for the purposes of public school education integration. Some of the more extreme policies supported or promoted by Judge Roberts that the NAACP finds most harmful include the fact that he was a principal architect of opposition to the effects test under the Voting Rights Act. The effects test allows voting discrimination to be proven even if discriminatory motivation to deny or abridge the right to vote could not be demonstrated, as long as you could establish a discriminatory outcome. Congress overwhelmingly voted to maintain the effects test in the Voting Rights Act. While working for the U.S. Department of Justice, Judge Roberts called the U.S. Civil Rights Commission's support of affirmative action circular and stated that there is, quote, no recognition of the obvious reason of failure. The affirmative action programs acquired the recruiting of inadequately prepared candidates, again, perpetuating stereotypes that affirmative action allows unqualified nominees to actually be placed in positions of authority in jobs and other places. Also, during his tenure at the Department of Justice, Judge Roberts fought to restrict the application of federal laws banning institutions that receive federal funds for discriminating in the Grove City College v. Bell case. He sought to narrow the law such that only specific programs receiving federal funds instead of the entire institution had to comply with civil rights protection laws. Congress later disagreed with Roberts by voting a broad application of the anti-discrimination provision. Judge Roberts criticized the U.S. Solicitor General's office for failing to support a Texas statute allowing school districts to deny enrollment for children of undocumented U.S. residents. In another instance, he concluded that it was within the Congress's authority to prohibit federal courts from ordering public school integration strategies such as busing, as I mentioned before. So finally, the NAACP is deeply concerned over what we've been able to find on Judge Roberts' record and continue to push for even more information to be made available to us. We were deeply concerned with the number of documents being held back and extremely important issues in areas such as affirmative action and the very controversial concern over papers disappearing between the visit by the Bush administration officials and those documents actually finally being sent to Washington for our evaluation.
Thank you, Hillary. Why don't you give your phone number in case people want to reach you, sidebar also.
Absolutely. 202-463-2940.
Thank you, Hillary Shelton of the NAACP. Operator, we'll now go to Q&A. If you can tell reporters how to punch in and put their questions.
Absolutely, sir. And for our phone participants, if you do have a question or comment at this time, we do ask that you please signal us by pressing star 1 on your touchtone telephone. Once again, that is star, followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone at this time.
As you all are asking your questions, if there's a particular one of our three participants that you want to ask the question to, just indicate that as you're putting your question. If you could also give your name and media organization as you ask your question, that would be also good. Operator, let's take the first question.
Our first question will come from Mark Grunberg with Press Associates.
Yeah, I have a question. I have one particular question for Judy Applebaum and then a question for the panel. The question for Ms. Applebaum, could you expand a little on that first piece that she was talking about where you repeatedly objected to heightened scrutiny and even where Brad Reynolds said that we should go ahead? And this is for everybody. I understand that he has a very narrow view of the Commerce Clause, which, of course, all of the legislation that we're talking about and all the decisions we're talking about are based. Is that correct, and does that raise red flags for all of you? That's correct.
Let's start with that question to Judy. Judy?
Sure. What I was referring to, the statements where he objected to heightened scrutiny for sex discrimination under the Constitution are in a couple of memos from 1981. But the case that I was referring to is reflected in a memo he wrote in 1982, and the case was called Canterino versus Wilson, Canterino versus Wilson. And it was a situation where the Civil Rights Division, headed by William Bradford Reynolds, had recommended that the Department of Justice intervene on the side of the plaintiffs in the suit. The suit was brought under both the Equal Protection Clause and Title IX, the statute against discrimination. And it challenged the Kentucky prison system's failure to offer female inmates the vocational training and work opportunities that it made available to male inmates, among other inequities. Roberts wrote a memorandum to the Attorney General recommending against intervention, in part, he said, because, quote, the equal protection claim will be based on semi-suspect treatment of gender classifications, and you, the Attorney General, have publicly opposed such approaches outside the area of race. So in our view, what that means is that Roberts was taking the view that the Justice Department could and should refrain from enforcing the law in order to avoid applying established Supreme Court precedent protecting against sex discrimination. He also, one of his other reasons for recommending against intervention was that the prison system's discriminatory treatment of women could be defended because of tight state prison budgets. That's a quote. Here he was disregarding the law, which did not permit that kind of defense to sex discrimination, and also the facts, because after the district court in the case ruled in the plaintiff's favor, the state didn't even appeal the vocational training aspects of the case. So that undercuts Roberts' view that the costs of eliminating the discrimination against women would have been prohibitive.
And on the Commerce Clause, does anybody want to comment on that? Whether, as the reporter asked, does that raise any red flags in terms of his position on the Commerce Clause?
Well, this is Jim Ward. I would just quickly add that the commerce power is one of the bases for Congress's passage of the ADA in addition to all the other laws we've talked about, or many of them. Roberts' interpretation would have dramatic implications for the ability to enforce many important provisions of the ADA. And it lies outside mainstream legal thought, but we'd be quite concerned about Roberts' presence on the Supreme Court and the ability to dramatically affect how the court views Congress's commerce authority in the future.
Anybody else want to comment on that? Okay. Operator, next question.
And our next question will come from James Brosnan with Scripps Howard News.
Yes, this is particularly for Judy Applebaum, but others can chime in. There was a, I'm with the Scripps Howard and the Birmingham Post-Herald. There was a key ruling earlier this year in which Justice O'Connor wrote the deciding opinion. It was a 5-4 decision, and that was the Jackson versus Birmingham Board of Education case, which in which she ruled that this high school coach could sue under Title IX, claiming that he'd been he'd lost his position because he had spoke up in favor of Title IX, and that was viewed as an important ruling dealing with the secondary impacts of discrimination. So, is it your contention that or fear that Roberts would have ruled the other way if he had been in O'Connor's seat?
Obviously a highly publicized case. Judy?
Yeah, well, it's certainly a question, and I should say that it's a case that the National Women's Law Center, my organization, was involved in. We represented
right.
Coach Jackson, so we're familiar with the case. And, you know, yes, that was one of several 5-4 decisions in which Justice O'Connor not only cast a decisive vote because the court was so closely divided, but she also wrote the court's opinion. And in that case, along with a number of others, she showed in the way she ruled and the way she wrote the opinion that she clearly understood what the purposes and intentions behind the sex discrimination prohibitions in Title IX and elsewhere are all about. And, in fact, I think she quoted in that case, as she has in others, the intention that the civil rights laws passed by Congress be given a sweep as broad as their language. And our concern about John Roberts is that when you look at the whole length and breadth of his career, he has repeatedly taken a very narrow approach to interpreting civil rights laws and applying civil rights laws, and I've given a few examples. And so, yes, there's very much a question in our minds about whether his taking the O'Connor seat would shift the court in a direction that would be very dangerous for women.
Peter, let's go to the next question, please.
Our next question will come from Sean Higgins with Investors Business Daily.
Hi, Sean.
Yes, this would be to Mr. Shelton. Regarding the effects test, is that related to what others have referred to more broadly as the access to courts issue? In other words, limiting the jurisdiction of the courts or whether or not a person has the standing in certain cases to sue?
Well, it speaks more to the evidence you need to be able to argue that discrimination has occurred in this particular case. The effects test says that you don't have to be able to show an intent. That is, oftentimes it's argued that you're not guilty of something unless you can prove an intent to discriminate. If the effect of the voting rights laws being applied in a particular place means that you're actually locking out all African-American voters, or you're locking out all women voters, or you're locking out all Hispanic voters from the voting process, then it's enough to show that the effect in the particular voting rights or election processes that you put into place can be very well violations of the Voting Rights Act. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Very good.
Operator, next question, please.
And for our phone audience, if you do have a question or comment, please signal us by pressing *1 on your touchtone telephone.
Okay, there's another question, operator.
We'll go to David Grace with IndieBay.org.
Yes, hi. I have actually three. One would be the Federalist Society. Regarding the Federalist Society, he was early claiming that he had no ties to them, and now it's been discovered that he was part of their steering committee. I wonder if you have any knowledge about the Federalist Society and this incident. The second one involves his the case involving Attorney General Gonzalez, who had written the infamous torture memos. He apparently was called for interviews with Bush in the midst of this case, and it's my understanding that in the 30 years earlier in the Watergate hearings, Richard Nixon had attempted to appoint judges to positions which would be hearing some of the it was written into the impeachment articles against Nixon that he had attempted to suborn judges in this way, and I wonder if you've got any knowledge of that. The third one has to do with whether or not there's any record of Roberts attempting to limit civil rights due to economic standards.
Judy, why don't you start any of those questions if you'd like?
Well, the only one that I feel equipped to possibly answer is the last one, but I'm not sure I understand it. Attempt to limit civil rights?
According to some sort of economic standards. In other words, that the civil rights are not inherent if there's going to be an economic cost. So if civil rights can be limited, if there's going to be a cost to a corporation or to some other entity.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen anything he's written on that subject in terms of law review articles or speeches that has been made publicly available. I would refer you, though, to the case that I spoke of a little earlier, the Cantorino versus Wilson case, where he was recommending against Justice Department participation on the side of the plaintiffs in a sex discrimination case, and one of his rationales for arguing that the department should stay out was that it might cost the defendant money to comply. Now, it's just a brief memo, and he doesn't articulate a whole theory, but it's troubling to us because it's so inconsistent with defenses that are allowed under civil rights claims.
Jim Ward with ADA Watch, and I would just respond to your first question, and I would be glad to forward by email if you requested these articles that we've seen come out of the Federal Society. There's been a number of speeches and articles released attacking the ADA, calling for the narrowing of the ADA with states' rights or federalism rationale. And I think in past judicial nominations, there has been significant pay made of members or nominees belonging to the Federal Society, so it does seem as if the administration tried to hide that fact. I would also point out that Mr. Roberts served on the Legal Advisory Council of the National Legal Center for the Public Interest, and this is an extreme organization that has promoted the very judicial, right-wing judicial activism that Senator Spector and others have decried. And they've attacked the ADA in numerous forums, including the publication of a document which belittled Congress's authority entitled Civil Rights and the Disabled, the Legislative Twilight Zone. So I think it is part of putting together the entire record of Mr. Roberts by looking at where he spends his time, who he associates with, and where he develops his philosophy.
Operator, let's go to the next question if there is one.
Mitch Jeserich with Pacifica Radio has our next question.
Yeah, I heard from Jim Ward specifically state that his organization is opposing the nomination of John Roberts. Just trying to find out, are Judy and Hillary, are your organizations also officially opposing the nomination, or are you taking a different stand?
Why don't we start with Judy?
Well, we haven't at this time, but we will be making an announcement that will reflect our thinking on that question tomorrow.
And the same thing will be true of the NAACP.
Okay. Any follow-up on that, Pacifica, or you want to pass?
Can you give any type of a hint? I mean,
no,
listening to you today, you obviously sound like you probably
right.
Won't be supporting them.
Right. I think they would prefer to save their formal announcement until tomorrow morning.
Well, just to say that based on the things we've shared so far, you realize how deep our concerns run with this particular nominee, and indeed we'll be prepared to make an announcement tomorrow.
Right. Operator, next question.
We'll take a follow-up from James Brosnan with Scripps Howard News.
So I was wondering, you know, a lot of the opposition to there is a lot of opposition that's being based on memos and things that he wrote in the Reagan administration 20, 25 years ago, and I'm roughly Robert's age, and I can think of a lot of things I opinions I held 20 years ago that I don't hold today. Would it have been more appropriate to wait and see how he responded to some of these questions about those opinions in the Judiciary Committee to see if experience and precedents set by the courts have changed his views or not, rather than take these positions now?
Judy, why don't you start with that one?
We'll, of course, we'll be very interested to hear exactly what he says in the hearing. We'll be following every word. But I want to correct part of the premise of your question. Take Title IX, for example. His repeated attempts to narrow the way the law was construed and applied weren't just in the early 80s during the Reagan administration. He did it then, for sure, in two different positions that he held, but again as Deputy Solicitor General and again in a brief he filed in private practice. So I don't think it's so easy in many of these areas to simply dismiss this as, you know, something that he did a long time ago or that, you know, he did where he took a different position later on. In fact, the pattern is consistent throughout the years.
And Jim Ward?
And I would just say that the pattern is what we're looking at, and that is these early writings are very much consistent with the cases he has chosen to work on in more recent years, as well as, again, his associations with the Federal Society and other organizations. So we piece together a pattern here that gives an idea where he stands and where he would place himself on the spectrum of right versus left, and do feel that his views represent a threat to the Americans with Disabilities Act.
And Hillary?
I'll just say that there is an extensive record, and whatever we announce tomorrow will be very well based on that record. And then, indeed, I agree with my two colleagues prior that there's been a consistency in his record. I've seen little to no reversal in positions and anything else that he's said or presented thus far. And certainly we'll be listening and watching very carefully as we go through the hearing process to see if he says anything to contradict the existing record.
Thank you very much. Operator, any final questions?
There are no further questions, sir.
Okay. We thank the press that has joined us for this audio conference. We thank the three participants. You have their phone numbers and, in some cases, the website address for additional information. If you need that, please feel free to give any of our three speakers a call. Thank you very much for listening in today, and we hope to provide some additional information as the hearing process goes on. Thank you very much.
And that does conclude today's teleconference. We would like to thank everyone for their participation and wish everyone...
And we thank you for listening, Indy Media, Indy Bay. So you are listening to Indy Media here in San Francisco, Indy Bay. And now let's go back to some previous programming. Let's see. You know, I'll put up a song or two, but maybe in a moment I'll be able to... yesterday we ran a great deal of the... down at Cindy Sheehan's camp, there's a radio station down there. So maybe we can get another feed from down there. Let's see if we can round that up.
This is America, and you're an American citizen, right?
Yes,
correct?
I am.
Okay, this is America, and in America, it's not the president who decides when we go to war, it's the Congress who decides when we go to war, and at the time the president asked the Congress to invoke the War Powers Act, he specifically said we must go to war.